The European Union Agency for Asylum, EUAA, says new refugee applications in the 27-country bloc are at a five-year high, mainly being submitted by Afghans and Syrians. On Wednesday, 19 refugees were found dead on the border between Turkey and EU nation Greece. It's believed they died from hypothermia. The European Commission claims it's trying to gather further information. EU Home Affairs ministers have been meeting to try and advance the bloc's new refugee policy, known as the Migration Pact.
The strategy of all or nothing up to now has actually given us nothing, and this is not good for member states or the European Union. We want to breathe new life into the EU Migration Pact.
When it comes to the refugee crisis, civil society organizations and many EU lawmakers make the point that the West never learns from its mistakes. They are expressing concern that stoking tensions with Russia over Ukraine has the potential to create a new refugee crisis. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. As the EU's Poland and Lithuania construct a new wall along their borders with Belarus, the European Commission is promising billions of euro to expand and arm the bloc's border agency, Frontex.
Frontex is by far the biggest agency we ever had. And we are setting it up right now, and it's huge. It's going to have 10,000 armed people at our external borders.
The EU's own data shows 100,000 children and teenagers go missing in the bloc every year. Most of those are refugees. Campaigners are calling for greater cooperation between police forces.
There need to be better information sharing platforms so we know exactly how many children are going missing and what are the actual risks that they face, because right now, nobody knows.
With EU nations refusing to take in refugees, and as billions are spent on keeping them out, rights groups are again asking, where are the bloc's much trumpeted values? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In overcrowded dinghies and often in the cover of darkness, migrants, among them people running away from wars and instability, take to the choppy waters separating France from the UK. Some make it. Others die trying. 27 of them in November last year alone. An incident that further strained the fragile ties between Paris and London. French President Emmanuel Macron says Britain's reliance on illegal immigrant labor is behind the surge in numbers crossing from France and in their deaths.
I think it's definitely political because he's getting set to run his election campaign. You know, we've had Brexit as well, so we know that that has impacted, but the reality is we're talking about human beings. So this is not about political point scoring, or it shouldn't be about political point scoring between governments.
Britain says the French president is absolutely wrong, that the government here is searching for ways to stop the crossings. This is what Interior Minister Priti Patel had to say in the wake of those tragic deaths in November.
We're not working just to end these crossings because we don't care or we're heartless. There's no quick fix. This is about addressing long-term pull factors, smashing criminal gangs that treat human beings as cargo, and tackling supply chains.
To do that, Britain wants France to let British police patrol French beaches. It has ruled out physically pushing boats back across the English Channel. It wants to give people traffickers life sentences and has introduced a controversial bill that will allow it to send migrants to detention centers in other countries. To campaigners, that is draconian and racist.
The Nationality and Borders Bill seeks to make it even more difficult for people to seek asylum in Britain, which again is a contravening international human rights laws. It will also mean that there's a higher scrutiny of people. There are tighter deadlines as it stands.
More than 28,000 migrants crossed the English Channel in 2021, triple the number the year before.
And while British and French leaders continue to trade accusations, more desperate migrants will embark on that perilous journey across the English Channel. And that will almost certainly mean more deaths. Saeed Pourreza, London.
revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally.
For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system whereby, I mean, here in this country we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of a public sphere, and so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence of faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here, and they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth, they're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London. Come April, many Britons will have to choose between heating and eating. Everything from bus fares to mortgages are going to cost more. Interest rates have gone up twice in 7 weeks, and three more hikes are on the horizon as the central bank tries to tackle the situation. The opposition members of parliament are livid, saying the government is incompetent.
He doesn't like it, Mr. Speaker, when children in my constituency go to bed with no food in their tummies, with no heat in their homes. What does he really think is the honourable position of a Chancellor who has just allowed one of his policies directly to be taken in fraud, £4.3 billion of fraud under his watch? Any other Chancellor that I've known would come to the House today to resign.
This week, millions learnt that their gas and electricity bills are going to jump 54%. The government says there's nothing it can do with energy prices going up worldwide.
I don't believe them at all. You know, I'm sure they know, you know, and this is just to put people more in poverty, you know. And it's not right, it's not fair, you know. People working very hard.
When you look at the price of things now, everything going up higher than it was. And that's why so many people on the street, living on the street, because they can't afford to eat or drink.
Oh, I feel like it's government responsible to support people who are in this horrible situation. Because I had a problem this year myself. I couldn't find an apartment because the prices went up crazy twice.
Also causing inflation to rise is supply chain issues, higher import taxes and wages increasing.
Brexit, the pandemic, and a global energy crisis, a perfect storm for Britain, now in the grips of its worst economic slump in 300 years. But who will have to pay for it all?
On April 1st, the cost of living will be going up £3,000 a year for each household. On the very same day, British politicians will be getting a £2,000 a year pay rise. From this, it is clear that those that are on top of the pile have their bills covered, and it's those on the breadline that will be picking up those bills. Bianca Rahimi, London.
$110,000 relief packages for 110,000 underprivileged families are loaded on trucks and are ready to go to their destinations. The humanitarian gesture was initiated by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Tehran. The IRGC says the charity supplies contain staple food, health items, and dowries for newlywed couples.
110,000 aid packages are being dispatched to families with low income, but they focus on those who have lost their businesses during the pandemic. The majority of the charitable supplies include the necessary items needed for an average family in a month. We have also provided 313 dowries for 313 newly wed couples.
The humanitarian gesture comes as part of nationwide celebrations marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The IRGC says one of the goals of this move is to share the festive mood with those in need.
We're celebrating the 43rd year after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. So we want to spread joy and happiness by helping those who cannot make ends meet. If we the people join hands and help each other, no foreign plot and no sanctions can bring us to our knees.
While the IRGC is known as a military institution, it has a strong presence in social and economic arenas. It says it feels bound to serve the Islamic Republic whenever there's a call to action, be it military or civilian. Every year during the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, charities in Iran ramp up their activities. The IRGC says the occasion is a chance to put a smile on the faces of the less privileged families, in line with one of the slogans of the Islamic Revolution, and that's the elimination of poverty. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Food and energy prices are soaring across the 19-nation eurozone, placing enormous pressures on cash-strapped consumers. Inflation hit a record high of 5.1% in January. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Wednesday.
I'm highly concerned about the combination of high and increasing levels of inflation and a central bank that refuses to normalize its monetary policy.
The story is not the same everywhere. For example, Belgium has an inflation rate of 8%. In France, it's just 2.5%.
Hence, we will see divergence in international competitiveness of the member states of the euro area. We've seen in the past the misery that comes about when you have that kind of development.
The economic impact of COVID-19 has disproportionately hit young adults in the EU. Homelessness and mental health problems are rife. For example, here in Belgium, PreventSuicide.be published a report on Tuesday showing calls to its helpline have skyrocketed. A record 22,000 were made last year, an increase of 20% on the previous year. The vast majority of those desperately reaching out for support are young people. Due to growing public debt, EU governments have been cutting investment in crucial areas such as education.
That cannot be the right way forward. We are increasingly in a knowledge economy in Europe. We need to invest in our people to really be competitive.
The potential fallout from a conflict between Western-backed Ukraine and Russia is fueling economic uncertainty in the EU.
This is something we have to factor into our economic analysis. And geopolitical tensions and issues, of course, have to be recognised.
Some EU lawmakers say the West should stop provoking Russia and instead put the best interests of citizens first. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
France's ambassador to Mali has been kicked out of the country in a major blow to the neo-colonial sphere of influence known as France-Afrique. The reasons included undiplomatic language from Paris towards a new military government in the capital of Bamako, but also sanctions on Mali, which have raised food prices, and especially the failure of almost a decade of French-led war. France first declared war in overwhelmingly Muslim Mali without the United Nations' approval, allegedly to fight religious extremists. 9 years later, with thousands dead and a million refugees, public opinion has turned massively against France.
Polls show that 80% of Malians in the capital think that France was only there to defend French interests. It's an opinion which Paris has blamed on Russian disinformation.
Public opinion is also reportedly strongly supportive of expelling the French ambassador, as well as of the military.
Dans la vision occidentale,
in the Western vision of things, there isn't a desire to respect the majority will of these people, or to help install a minimum of democracy, and thus a government with a minimum of credibility. If you install a government which is pro-Western and which doesn't reflect the popular will, then of course you will create anti-occupation sentiment because you become a hostile force yourself.
The bold move by Mali comes just days after Burkina Faso's military seized the heads of state, even as French soldiers were on a mission in the country. In the past 18 months, other revolts in Guinea, as well as in Chad and Niger, have many wondering if France is losing its neo-colonial hold on sub-Saharan Africa.
Les intérêts français dans la région.
France's interests in the region are threatened by new players such as China, Russia, and even Qatar, which has invested a lot there. We can no longer say this is a region which is under total French domination, because there is now competition. However, as long as the local governments are corrupt, they can be easily influenced by foreign powers.
France's military has stalled for time, saying a total military withdrawal from Mali will be discussed in the coming days. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Islamic Revolution revives a Muslim woman's model. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Iran's Islamic Revolution triumphed with the presence of the whole Iranian nation from all walks of life. Yet, women played a very outstanding and effective role in this regard. Before the revolution, the Western view on women was dominant in Iran, and the Shah regime had done its best to fight all human values in women to turn them into the tool of implementing the American and European goals in the country. The instrumental look on women had begun since 19th century and reached Iran in early 20th century, but it reached its climax in 1970s with the growth of materialistic thoughts and technological and cinematic progress. Thus, secularism spread all over the country. This thought deemed no value for religion in society and politics, and limited it to individual life. Europe and the United States were introduced as the examples of progress and ideal life, and religion was introduced as the enemy of modernism and progress. The first ruler of the Pahlavi regime, Reza Khan Mir Panj, was an illiterate and self-conceited man who was a servile stooge of colonialists. In view of this, he blindly followed the dictates of his masters in the West, and as one of his first steps in modernizing Iran, he ordered the prohibition of hijab by women. Thus, the military and police of the regime would beat women and force them to remove their chador and scarf in public. Many ladies preferred not to go outdoors for years to keep their chastity and dignity. As his date was expired, Reza Khan was dethroned by the British, and his equally servile son, Mohammad Reza, was brought to the throne by Britain. Mohammad Reza continued his father's path. He left no stone unturned to change the Iranian lifestyle into a Western one. He himself was a licentious man to the extent that some writers wrote down his immoral, behind-the-scene lifestyle in their books and memoirs. Ali Shahbazi was one of the forces of the Shah's special guard who wrote in his memoir, "From the time of Asadullah Alam's premiership, his ministry had set up a special center for entertainment of Shah. Their job was to bring married women, beautiful girls or wives, and daughters of those who wanted to obtain a position for the Shah." The great leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said on the oppression and injustices that women had suffered during the Pahlavi regime, "Woman has been oppressed in two phases. One was during the Jahiliyyah, or the period of pre-Islam ignorance, which Islam did a favor to human being and took woman out of the injustice and oppression she was in. The other one was in our Iran that woman was oppressed, and it was during the era of the former Shah and his successor. Claiming that they want to liberate woman, they wronged women. They took woman down from the position of nobility and dignity that she had. They turned woman from the position of a spirituality into an object. And in the name of freedom, free women and free men, they took freedom away from woman and man and made women and youth immoral." Imam Khomeini believed that woman has a dignified and lofty status. She can reach the highest degree of spirituality while engaging in scientific, political, and social activities. He said that the ultimate goal for mankind, regardless of their gender, is to get proximity of God. Being a servant of God and worshiping Him is not limited to gender. The Imam said, "Woman is a human, and that's a great human. Woman is the educator of society. It is from the woman's lap that humans are trained. It is from the woman's lap that man ascends to heavens. Happiness and misery of countries depend on woman. Woman makes human being through her correct training and develops the country through her correct training." Imam Khomeini then refers to the view of Islam and the beautiful conduct of the Prophet of Islam toward woman, saying, "The history of Islam is witness to the unbounded respect of the Messenger of God to his daughter. To this noble child, Lady Zahra, peace be upon her, to show that woman holds a special greatness in society to the extent that, if it is not superior to man, it is not less than him." Imam Khomeini used to recommend women to strive in acquisition of knowledge and attaining moral virtues, as they are the source of happiness and every good thing for society. Years into the victory of the Islamic Revolution, effective efforts have been made to survive women's dignity in Iran. Muslim women of Iran have achieved many progresses in a variety of domains, such as sciences, sports, technologies, arts, and so on. They have strongly proved that having hijab is by no means an obstacle on the way of reaching pinnacles of progress. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "Woman, in the logic of Islam, has a perfect model and a structure. An Islamic woman is the creature which has faith and chastity. She holds the most important part of training human being. She is effective in society. She has scientific and spiritual growth. She is the administrator of the very important family center and the source of calm for the male gender. All these exist beside female characteristics like fineness, tender-heartedness, and preparedness for reception of divine rights. And this is the model of the Islamic woman. On the contrary, there has always been a deviated model in history. Today, that deviated model is the Western woman, whose characteristic, instead of those outstanding and lofty ones, which we mentioned for Islamic woman, is to be able to draw the attention of men and please them. Thus, the Western woman is characterized by nakedness. You can see that a man should be fully clothed in their ceremonies, while a woman should be as naked as possible."
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israel's membership at the AU, the African Union, has become a source of controversy. The African Union has suspended a debate on whether to withdraw Israel's accreditation. This is happening despite growing calls on the bloc to overturn last year's decision to grant Israel an observer status. Why the controversy? Overall, many African Union member countries consider Israel an apartheid regime. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Israel's intentions behind its desire to be an AU member, especially in the context of so-called normalization.
Israel once again at the heart of an international rift and controversy, this time within a usually united body valuing consensus, the African Union. A row so fierce that the bloc was forced to suspend a debate on whether to rescind Israel's observer status and postpone a potentially divisive vote. The rare dispute within the 55-member body was set in motion last July. That's when Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, unilaterally accepted Israel's accreditation to the bloc. A slew of criticism followed. Powerful members, including South Africa and Algeria, were among the many protesting that the decision had been taken without consultations. They also argued that the decision flew in the face of African Union statements supporting the Palestinian territories. The AU has called for an end to the Israeli occupation and an independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Israel received AU observer status after 20 years of diplomatic efforts. The quest is largely seen as part of the regime's US-backed campaign to normalize ties with African and Arab countries such as Morocco, Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain. but analysts believe the normalization does not enjoy popular support.
Of course, Israel has hitherto been, of course, unaccepted in Asia or in West Asia. And although you've got clandestinely nations like Saudi Arabia who have been dealing with it, and others more over, like Jordan and Egypt, etc., you've nonetheless got this kind of fear amongst leaderships in West Asia, even now, of openly becoming part of the Israeli syndicate. Because the people, ultimately at the grassroots, certainly the Arab people, are not happy with the idea of Israel being accepted.
Palestine gained observer status at the African Union in 2013. Its Prime Minister, Mohamed Shtayyeh, addressed the bloc's latest summit held at the weekend. He called for Israel's accreditation to be revoked.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion. This must stop.
Resistance movement Hamas has also slammed granting Israel the observer's status. Hamas says the move is a flagrant violation of the principles and statute of the African Union, which reject racism and demand decolonization and the right to self-determination. The African body has now set up a six-country committee to review Israel's observer status and submit its findings during an assembly next year, a decision that will ultimately come down to whether or not the bloc will stick to its anti-colonial and anti-racist principles.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, is a journalist and Middle East expert. She joins us from London. Also joining us, Netfa Freeman, Pan-African Community Action, Black Alliance for Peace, joins us from Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, let me start with you, and if you can give us a backdrop as to what is going on here, what's the controversy all about? We understand Moussa Faki Mohammed, the chair of the African Union Commission, accepted Israel's defense status in the bloc without consultations from what we understand, and maybe that is what sort of put the spotlight on this and then create the controversy. But what exactly has happened?
Well, the controversy actually stems from the fact that many peoples across the African continent refuse to recognize or acknowledge the legitimacy of the State of Israel. Obviously, Arab countries are opposed to it in solidarity with the Palestinian people, but of course, the African continent itself has suffered from colonialism and therefore understands the plight of the Palestinian people and is not in solidarity at all with Israel in general terms. There are obviously pockets here and there where there's been influence from Christian fundamentalists, American Christian fundamentalists across the continent that have influenced various communities to go towards supporting the State of Israel. But in general terms, of course, across the continent, there is consensus that colonialism is wrong, is morally reprehensible, and therefore, because Israel represents the last, in fact, colonial outpost in the region, it has to be opposed. So the controversy stems first from actually taking this decision, second, obviously, unilaterally, but of course, again, because it goes against the Charter of the African Union, which recognizes that before any moves towards normalization with Israel in general terms has to be made on condition that Palestinian rights be respected, and of course that isn't the case. Of the background, obviously, to this, there are many issues happening behind the scenes, in particular in the way Israeli companies are actually looking to get a foothold in the numerous sectors of natural resources of countries like, for instance, Congo or Rwanda, hence the move for normalization and for increased presence, Israeli presence, should I say, across the African continent.
Sure. You just went through five of our questions here that I was going to ask, but that's okay. Let's expand on all of them. The one that really struck me, aside from the fact that this observer status was introduced, is the one about the charter. So let me ask you, Netfa Freeman, you have a charter of the African Union that is well known to its member countries, but yet you have the chair of the African Union Commission to have accepted Israel's observer status. This was going to come out anyways, you know, so why did this proceed? Of course, Hafez Karim Mustafa gave us some very good reasons, but you give us yours.
Well, I think that this whole thing, you know, the accreditation of Israel to the African Union should have never been considered, and it actually reflects the full-blown subservience of the African Union to neocolonialism. The previous speaker was talking about colonialism, and we have to look at the specific forms of colonialism. That most of the member states, they're not representing the wishes and the sentiments of the masses of the people in their different countries. And so it also reflects the fact that these countries are really not people-centered democracies, and that Africa used to be the vanguard of global solidarity with Palestinians and against Zionism and settler colonialism. And so the charter is really, you know, like the UN Charter and like the U.S. Constitution and all these things are circumvented, are just sidelined by the powers that be in the world. If you look at contradictions, like for the fact that Haiti, actually, you know, pretty much an African country, you know, can't even enjoy or be regarded with accreditation to the African Union, it shows that the charter means very little when it comes to leveling the power of the global dominance that characterizes white supremacy and settler colonialism in the world.
So, Hafez Karim Mustafa, we have the fact that you mentioned, and our guest there from Washington, D.C. also mentioned, how Israel is shunned by many of the African countries. And I'd like to know the percentage, if you can state that. But I'm sure Israel is aware of that also. So what happened is we had this so-called normalization occur. I'm wondering if the normalization was a prelude to Israel being accepted in return for, I'm not too sure, economic perhaps dividends of some kind coming from Israel. Is that what the African countries were promised in return? Is that how it went down, do you think?
It depends of each different country. In the case of Sudan, for instance, we know that Sudan was going through a major financial crisis, and therefore it was promised financial support from the U.S. in exchange for normalization. We know that other countries, for instance, if you take the RDC, for instance, which has the largest reserves of copper in the continent and actually across the world, we have various interests, and that's the most important thing, actually, diamond mines in the region. We know, if you take on board the fact that Tel Aviv is the main platform for diamond exchange, then you will know that the relation with Africa, that actually Israel is dependent on African resources, but because African governments are in turmoil in these regions, they're actually having to depend on Western companies, or in this case, Israeli companies, to trade their product. And so there's this sort of unhealthy relationship that has developed between African governments, which are in turmoil, which are very often corrupt, and these countries such as Israel or the U.S. I mean, it's difficult to differentiate between the two because they obviously both work in the same sense, in terms of destroying African economies, keeping the continent in constant turmoil in order to exploit its natural resources. So when we go back to what the root causes of this desire for normalization, it is to get a hand on African resources, but of course also to increase the normalization, because the more countries normalize with Israel, the more legitimacy Israel feels it has, and therefore feels that its presence is no longer threatened in any way, shape, or form.
Sure. So this legitimacy that Hafez Karim Mustafa mentions, Nefer Freeman, is something that it needs to be recognized by the African countries. Unfortunately, we know that many African governments, I'm not going to say a lot, but many of them are known to be corrupt. But I'm wondering what kind of pressure may be exerted on the governments to accept Israel into their mainstream, I guess, business, so that they can not only reap the rewards off their corruption, but also then have Israel come in, and again, as our guest on London said, to somewhat take advantage of the natural resources, number one being at the top of the list, again, as our guest in London said.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that the United States has been the biggest supporter of Israel throughout its existence and gives, you know, lots of financial support to Israel, and that has been behind some of the pressures exerting on some of the countries, like, for example, Sudan was mentioned. And one of the things that alleviates Sudan's, you know, economic issue is that it being on the terrorist list. So that was a promise that was given to United. That was, I guess, a promise or a negotiated thing between primarily the United States and Sudan. So the United States is really behind some of these maneuvers. We also know that a lot of the United Nations resolutions in the General Assembly, you know, that Israel doesn't get enough support, largely a lot of times because some of these, despite their corruption, that their resolutions are things are not voted for, the things that would favor Israel. These kind of moves also take alleviate the isolation of Israel and Zionism, the exposure of Zionism as an inhumane system. And so these are the kind of things that happen. I think also we can't take Israel out of the global context of, and I would say, I would consider desperation of white supremacy and a pan-European project of really trying to hold international dominance, and particularly its competition with other forces in the world, China, Russia. And so it's trying to shore up as much as it can or sway as much as it can its influence, and Israel is a big part of that. A lot of Israel behind the scenes in terms of how the United States dominates the continent of Africa through military arms sales and things like that. A lot of that, Israel is involved in those kind of things. And then, like we say, the international trade through diamonds and those types of things are very important. But we can't underestimate the role that the Western countries, particularly the United States, plays in this scenario.
Sure. Well, as we go through our daily lives, Hafsakar Mustafa, Israel is doing a fantastic job of violating the Palestinian rights. And recently, there was a 280-page report that talks about how Israel, in a matter of just summarizing it, is an apartheid regime. So Israel is racking up its report card very well with these types of not only violations, but also reports that come out condemning it to that effect. Doesn't that make it very difficult for organizations like the AU to even consider having Israel come on board?
Well, I think the fact that they've had this latest decision proves that they've realized the massive mistake and are sort of trying to backtrack from it. I think it's a good sign that pressure was exercised on the AU Council to actually rescind the invitation. And so I think that the added pressure coming from Western NGOs can only make the case stronger. I mean, I think it's a bit sad that we'd have to rely on Western NGOs to actually make a case for Palestinian oppression or for the apartheid nature of the Israeli regime. But I think that does go some way in saying that even if countries that are normally friendly towards Israel are now acknowledging that it's a racist entity, that it practices apartheid, that means that there is no excuse for countries who have suffered from apartheid, who've suffered from colonialism, to actually engage in any way with a terrorist entity such as Israel.
Yeah, I'd like to get some reflections here on some people who are well-known within the Israeli community and their account of what apartheid is. And Netha Freeman, let me quote here Yossi Sarid, a former Israeli cabinet minister, ex-leader of the opposition, a member of the Knesset for 32 years, who back in 2008 said, quote, "What acts like apartheid, is run like apartheid, and harasses like apartheid is not a duck. It is apartheid." And there's been many Israeli, political figures who have also led a hand in categorizing Israel as an apartheid regime. Ehud Barak, Ehud Olmert, they all talked about it also in those with a similar stance. So if you have Israeli officials labeling Israel itself as an apartheid regime, then that says something, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It says something. It's really, and the apartheid as a system can be obscured by the normalization of countries like the United States. The United States is an apartheid country. It's a settler colony, but people don't see it that way. But because of the, I think we call the increasing fascist nature and the untenable situation in Israel as, you know, illegitimate state, then there are those who have to acknowledge, you know, what is done. I don't even, it's hard to even say the increased fascism, because it's really, Israel really has just really existed on this type of you know, behavior or foundation ever since its existence. But at this point, I think the world is waking up to the natures and fundamental nature of Zionism and what it really entails, that it is racism, that it is settler colonialism, which in fact is apartheid in a statutory way. And so, yes, I think it says a lot, but it's also reflective of the increasing illegitimacy, crisis of legitimacy that Israel's facing along with the rest of the Western nations.
Hafsakar Mustafa, the possibilities of what we're looking at in Africa in terms of the U.S. involvement. Our guest talked about it, Netva Freeman. You know, we're witnessing an Africa that's somewhat unstable. In the past, over a year now, we've witnessed 7 coups that have happened here. Now, I'm not saying there's a direct relationship between the coups and the U.S., but overall, we have some Western traces in some of these coups. France has been actually... accused of it when it comes to countries like Mali. But what my question is there a possibility that the U.S. and then in turn maybe by default Israel sees opportunities when it comes to instability in certain African countries to try to move in and then have Israel obviously be introduced to these countries?
Well, absolutely. I think turmoil is essential to Western economies, and I don't mean just for the U.S. or Israel. I think for all Western countries, because all countries across the world, in fact, are reliant on African resources. It's not just copper, it's not just gold, it's not just diamond, it's also uranium, it's also a whole plethora of things that exist only on the African continent that are essential for computers, for nuclear technology, for all these things that are only found on the continent. So it is essential to keep African markets going. But of course, in order to keep prices down, the ideal scenario is to have the African countries in constant turmoil. Once they're in constant turmoil, once they're constantly embroiled in civil conflict, in wars, in coups, they can't control the markets, they can't control the prices of the products that they're exporting, and therefore they're reliant completely on Western countries buying at the prices that they deem fit, which is why you will always find a Western imprint on any coup, on any civil conflict that is occurring on Africa. Whether we like it or not, it isn't some sort of conspiracy theory about a foreign hand. There is always a Western hand in any scenario that has taken place in the last 50 years on the continent, precisely to keep the prices of the natural resources down and allow Western markets to exploit African resources.
One of the headlines that I'd like to ask you, Netva Freeman, is the UAE taking steps to gain control of Sudan's main port. Now, there is an intense cooperation and collaboration, I should say, between the UAE and Israel when it comes to Yemen, on the southern side, I guess, Socotra Island, and then that main waterway there. And it is said this collaboration is somewhat the spark to have Israel and the UAE move along African ports and try to, I guess, take control of them, as we can see here. Whether together or whether separately, I'm not sure. This particular headline talks about the UAE doing that. Do you think then that the so-called normalization with Israel would be characterized by these types of actions?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is all in line with trying to shore up Israel's ability and influence as a player on the African continent. I don't want to claim to know enough about this particular issue, so I haven't studied that issue enough. I know that, but obviously it's clear that, you know, United Arab Emirates and Yemen, and what's happening there is supported by the West, and that they want, and it has a lot to do with resources, like the other guest is saying, a lot of it has to do with resources. But I will say this about that, and if I can comment on the last question, I agree with everything our other guest is saying. I would add, though, that when it comes to the coups on the continent of Africa, it's a bit more complicated in the sense that the neocolonialism is becoming untenable by the masses of the people, and you'll see that some of the people are cheering on some of the coups when they take place. So it's not just a matter of the militaries that are trained by French Foreign Legion or AFRICOM or something, but it's also the masses of the people who are actually decrying the neocolonial, the comprador class, and that the emboldened military class is taking advantage of that. But there's a groundswell, particularly in the French former colonies, against neocolonialism, and that also is a factor that cannot be ignored.
Sure. How does the camera stop? I'm going to ask the same question to you, because I believe that this actually has some depth to it when it comes to the Israeli and the UAE collaboration. It really appears like, and I'm sifting through some of these headlines, that this is a collaboration that is very deep, and that they are citing the fact that together they want to move down into African ports, perhaps. Sudan is one of them that the UAE in particular has gone through. We know UAE has been involved in Africa, for example, in Libya and elsewhere. So the normalization is a good way, just like the Israel becoming an AU, which at this point has been rescinded, I guess observer status membership is rescinded, that the normalization would lead to that. Is that what we're looking at in that context?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the islands of Socotra and the south of Yemen. These are major, major trade routes that have been responsible for the prosperity of East Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, and even further up towards India and Iran. So these are incredibly important routes. And if the Israelis get a foothold in these straits that are very, very strategic for commerce in this area, this is extraordinarily dangerous for the stability of the region, because we know that obviously Israel has no principle. It is a terrorist regime, and it will do whatever it takes for its own interests, including destabilize entire regions just to get a foothold and a control of these very important strategic routes. So it's a very, very dangerous development, and it shows the depth of collaboration with the UAE, and also again the subservience of the UAE towards Israel. The question now is how far the UAE is willing to go, and why is it going this far? Because obviously, if we can understand, and I'm not in any way justifying the Sudanese decision, but if we can understand that economic uncertainty has pushed Sudan in this direction, there is no valid reason for the UAE to actually engage so closely with Israel, given that its economy is doing extraordinarily well. So there is something afoot going on here. It's very difficult to establish what the reason is, but absolutely, it is a very, very dangerous development for the stability of the region and for the African continent as well.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to end it there. Habsakar Mustafa, thank you for your input. Journalist and Middle East expert from London. And Netfa Freeman, thank you. Pan-African Community Action, Black Alliance for Peace from Washington, D.C. Thank you for your input. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of